This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. From Michael Palin's diary, Wednesday, May 13, 1970, written at Torquay, a beach resort in England. It was another hot day, and Graham and I, in leisurely fashion, drove round to the Imperial Hotel. Here we spent what must rate as one of the most luxurious and effortlessly pleasant mornings of my life. We lay in the sun beside a beautiful heated seawater pool and had gin and tonics brought to us. We drove out to the location and spent the afternoon playing football, dressed as gynecologists. The absurdity of days like that pop up repeatedly as Michael Palin chronicles the birth of his children, his father's decline into Parkinson's disease, breakfasts, dinners, and, oh, along the way, the evolution of a cultural phenomenon. Palin and five others formed Monty Python at about the same time that he started his family, quit smoking, and resumed the childhood habit of keeping a diary. Michael Palin joins us to talk about it in just a moment. Later in the program, we have an email challenge for you. How did your life change today? First day of kindergarten, first day of college, terrible traffic Tuesday, your boss came back from vacation. The day after Labor Day, how did your life change? Email us, talk@npr.org, plus local laws that prohibit saggy pants. But first, Michael Palin. His new book collects his diaries from 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. If you have questions about the group and its influence, or about keeping a diary, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address again is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Michael Palin, nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil. Nice to be here.
You cover an awful lot of ground in these diaries, but you do miss some of the critical moments in the history of Monty Python. How could you skip over the birth of the Ministry of Silly Walks?
Well, good question. I guess at the time it was a diary about my life, and Python was one part of my life. My children growing up was another part. My dental problems were another part. And who would imagine that Silly Walks, anyway, in 40 years' time, was still going to be asked for and seen and laughed at? It was just another comedy show then. And I'm sorry for all those who want to know secrets like that. But I must say, as Python hung on through the 70s and made the transition from television to movies, I seem to write a lot more about it. So I think I must be aware that it was beginning to mean something.
But at that time, particularly in those first few seasons, the group was constantly in danger of breaking up. I'm halfway through your book, by the way, and I think it's about the sixth time that you've written, this is the day Monty Python died.
I know. Which is good about diaries, I think, as opposed to an autobiography or something with hindsight involved, because one wouldn't repeat that. You'd just say, Python carried on until and then finished. But we did did live from hand to mouth in a way. You know, John was keen to leave halfway through the second series. John was much better known than any of the rest of us, probably had more offers, and was notoriously sort of careful about what he wanted to do. And I think he felt that Python had done all it could by the middle of the second series. Others of us felt, you know, we'd done so much, we were just beginning to get good ratings, we enjoyed working together so much that we should keep it together. But it's fascinating. Python was a group of people all flying off in different directions. It's like a centrifugal force, when harnessed, worked very, very strongly.
You wrote in 1973, my God, we're all getting so mercenary.
Yes. We didn't know the meaning of mercenary then.
Hadn't even gotten
nothing
to be
mercenary
then.
About.
Yeah, that's right.
This was asking for an extra £50 a week for the series. But there were commercials and ads around and all that. And of course, I was getting offered, five times as much as I would get for a series of Python to advertise sausages at one point. You know, I just thought, I've got to stay true to Python.
Of which you write, the pride swallowing things one does for money, the voiceover is the least painful.
Yes, I think that was about it.
Our guest is Michael Palin. He's published his diaries from 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Mike, and Mike's calling us from Ithaca, New York.
Hello, Neil and Michael and everyone else.
Hi.
Actually, I wanted to talk about two things, but they told me to mention one of them first. So I'll say that I quoted Monty Python in my doctoral thesis, and it was published in the Journal of Theoretical Biology in December of 1981.
Wow. Well, that's what we'll have. Our lawyers will be on to you straight away.
It was in the Eric the Hafabee poem.
Really?
Because people had represented genotypes when you had multiple alleles. They would use arrows to represent vectors for genotypes.
You lost me at alleles.
I liked arrows. It's
an alternative form of a gene.
Well, take your word for it that it was apt.
But what happened, though, is the arrows had to be half-length for the males because the males have half the normal of chromosome numbers. And when people were using full-length arrows for the males, it didn't work. But you could predict the sex ratios when you made the males half as long. So the part about can a bee be said to be an entire bee, it's true for ants as well as bees.
Well, that's great.
Were you guys aware of male haploidy?
I wasn't particularly, no. But females haploidy, but not male.
Of course, is in Harry Potter, when Harry is introduced to the chocolate frogs that the wizards eat, and he was new to the wizard world, he says, are those real frogs?
Yeah.
And the other part is when Ron, who becomes Harry's best friend on the train on the first day to school.
We've wandered off into the wrong cultural phenomenon here.
No, but there's Monty Python in there, lots of it.
All right.
What happened is Ron says, are you Harry Potter? Or are you him? And he goes, who? He goes, Harry Potter. And Harry says, oh, yeah, him. And it's sort of that typical Northern English humor that's so beautiful, actually.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for the call, and continued good luck using that doctorate, putting that doctorate to good use.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And why don't we go to, this is Jerry. Jerry's with us from St. Charles. St. Charles where?
Missouri,
go ahead, please.
Yes, well, I just want to congratulate or compliment Mr. Palin on the, he wrote a very literate, wonderful book on Ernest Hemingway. Oh. That I believe was adapted from a travel series that you did.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that I picked it up at a remainder area of the
At least you picked it up.
Store.
I don't care where they get it from, so long as someone reads it. Was that the Hemingway adventure?
Yes, and it was I've read Hemingway and read a lot about him, but I thought it was a very unique way to capture his past and having been done so long after he had passed on. And So I just want to compliment you on that, and also say that my daughters gifted me last year with the 16-ton mega set, and some of these things, it's been 30 years since I've seen. I am amazed how much, not only can I remember them, but my friends and I can do some of the sketches to the point that drive our wives, our significant others, absolutely crazy. So it has lasted, and I hope my children have the same effect.
Oh, thanks.
All right,
that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for the call, Jerry. I wanted to ask you about some of the process. You describe a lot of days, you know, went over to Terry's and wrote for the Morning Good Day Bet, and you came up with 4 minutes of material. What were you actually doing during all that time to come up with 4 minutes of material?
4 minutes of material in a day, that was a heck of a lot. That really was a good day's writing. Because those 4 minutes were 4 minutes that you were prepared to read out to the rest of the group when we met up. So it had to be pretty good. Standards were quite high. I mean, we did occasionally try and get through stuff that wasn't up to standard, but that wasn't considered the right thing to do. So it was very competitive, and 4 minutes of finished material in a day was pretty good. So we'd be writing, rewriting, saying this line doesn't work, that line doesn't work. I remember an entire day when we were writing a barbershop sketch about a guy trying to avoid cutting someone's hair because he's kind of obviously a homicidal maniac, and the man in the chair sort of chatting away, and the guy sort of cutting, and you know, kind of terrified at using scissors, and they're making general chat, and we got to the end of this, and we just couldn't move it on, and in about 15 minutes, I think it was around about 6:30 to 6:45 in the evening, we decided, let's have one last go at finishing this sketch, and then we'll go to the pub. And we just said, I improvised something about, oh, I don't want to be a barber anyway. I wanted to be a lumberjack. And that happened within 15 minutes. And then we went to the pub with all the verses completed. So there's no method to it, really.
And that's where the lumberjack song came.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The lumberjack song was just it came out just like that. I mean, never had to be rewritten. But other days, you would take a long time over one sentence, one word. I mean, John was particularly careful. He'd take ages over sketches.
And so you wouldn't necessarily go to the group meeting with a sketch and say, look, I think this is awfully good, but I couldn't figure out how to finish it?
No, we would do that. Yeah, that happened. Yeah, absolutely. Because the great thing about Python, which I suppose made it different from things that had come before, was that we did we allowed fragments to be read out because we had Terry Gilliam's animation, we had clips of film, we had ways of stitching it all together. So anything that was good, even if it was just a couple of lines or one silly idea, as the Ministry of Silly Walks came from some other government department, Ministry of Silly Thoughts or something like that, it was worth just reading out a line if you felt it was good.
And there's also a question I had about process. The work would be done on the film elements of the shows, and then you would edit those and bring them back and then perform the other material live in front of an audience?
Exactly.
It took me a while to figure that out.
Yeah, I know. I perhaps should have put in more carefully a guide to how we did it. But what would happen is we would write maybe 8 shows of a 13-part series, send them to the BBC. They would break them down into the amount of film material in those first 8 shows. And that would be done over maybe 3 weeks, Yorkshire, Scotland, sometimes around London. Then the little film packages, as you rightly say, would be played into the show, which was recorded in front of an audience on Thursday nights at BBC Television Centre Studio 6, usually.
Our guest is Michael Palin, one of the ringleaders of the legendary Monty Python. His new book is called Diaries, 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. If you'd like to talk with Michael Palin, 800-989-8255. Email us to talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, Michael Palin and the Diaries of a Python. If you have questions about Monty Python and its influence or about keeping a diary, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. At the start of the show, we played a clip of the well-known parrot sketch from Monty Python's Flying Circus. Everyone has their favorite Python skit. Who can forget Michael Palin in this routine?
The Spanish Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise are 2 weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency are 3 weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope are 4. No. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as fear. I'll come in again.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Michael Palin along with Graham Chapman in a clip from Monty Python's Flying Circus. If you'd like to join us again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And why don't we go to, this is going to be Michael. Michael's with us from DeKalb in Illinois.
Oh, my goodness. What an extraordinary pleasure. Good afternoon, Mr. Palin. Good afternoon, Neil.
Hi. Hi, Michael.
Neil had mentioned a specific incident in Torquay in the open to your interview, and I was curious to know whether you'd ever had a chance to meet the hotelier that inspired John Cleese to create Basil Fawlty, who apparently ran a terrible place in Torquay. And then more generally, you know, whether there were specific people or situations you found yourself in that inspired characters or sketches in the show or the movies. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, thanks.
So extraordinary.
Bye.
The piece you read out earlier, the reason we were at the Imperial Hotel, which we couldn't really afford, was that we were all, first of all, put up at this hotel, at which there was a very difficult and disagreeable man who would sort of ask... I remember innocent questions like tomorrow morning, you know, could we have a morning call? A call? What sort of call? When? Well, sort of 6:45. 6:45? I mean, just an extraordinary character. And I remember we had our meal there in the evening, and Terry Gilliam was there, and Terry talks a lot while he eats, and he just sort of finished his meal and was just... talking away, and this man came in, leaned across the table, put the knife and fork together, and said to Terry, "In England, we put our cutlery like this." And so I'm afraid Terry, myself, and Graham couldn't bear this guy any longer. So we just we left the Glen Eagles Hotel, as it was called, and eventually ended up at the Imperial. John stayed on there, and that was the man who was the character on which Fawlty Towers was based, and which Basil Fawlty was based. So John stayed on very shrewdly.
Worth the price.
Yeah. But I mean, that there is the only other memory I have like that of a direct sort of instance of a character being inspiring a sketch was the Knights Who Say Nee. And that was, oddly enough, based on a history teacher I had at school. Very, very nice man. He would, we would sit in the history library and he'd say, "Look, well, read for half an hour, then we'll have a discussion." And while we read, he would go around the library and sort of squat down on the lower shelves and have a look at the books he wanted and all that, all the time saying, "Nee, nee." And it was quite off-putting, you trying to read the book. And this must have stuck in my brain years later with the Knights Who Say Nee. And I had a correspondence with him. I think he'd heard that this might be based on him. He thought it was wonderful. And very nice he didn't sue.
Let's go to Deborah. Deborah's with us from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you both for having me on the show.
Sure.
Nice to meet you, Neil and Mr. Palin.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I am actually currently reading your book. I am about around page 200, 1974, and I'm really enjoying it. And I am a Python fan, but you know I've read the Python stuff in the Big Gray Python book, and so
yes.
I'm really enjoying reading this about your perspectives on things.
Yeah.
I have to say, like I'm really enjoying reading your views on the current history of the time, and I'm just enjoying the perspective. I was in London only for 4 months to study abroad, and I remember some streets, some names. I had a quick history course, you know, just to so I could sort of talk with locals.
Yeah,
but just learning about, you know, kind of relearning about the coal strikes and, you know, Tory control and
yes.
power outages and your, you know, views on Nixon. And I mean, you were reporting the facts, but then you were also giving a subjective point of view, which I have to find I find similar to my own opinion. But you know, it was a very enjoyable way to read history.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because I mean, the diaries are an account of my days spent during the 70s. Python was part of it, but I say there were many other factors as well. And you couldn't sometimes just ignore the way history intruded, especially when we had three-day weeks, blackouts, the IRA bombings and all that sort of thing. And in many ways, it was a pretty grim time. The old sort of Tory Conservative Party were trying to sort of reassert themselves. Their miners stood up to them and were rallied around, and there were huge strikes. President Nixon, I think, was elected in America, which I have to say, you know, Terry and I were just so utterly, unutterably depressed when we heard that.
Well, yeah,
and we followed American politics. We were very interested in America, and we felt something's going wrong here. America should be ahead with the days of JFK. We were brought up in all that. And,
Yeah, you see, when you were in California, in fact, that at one point Terry Jones, you know, kind of resigned for the night to watch the Watergate trial,
yes,
because it was on constantly.
Yes,
and
yeah.
It's very impactful. It's neat to hear that. But I also wanted to comment that I've had trouble with my own diaries, and that it's hard to keep the stuff, the kind of negative attitude out, and trying to report things objectively. And at one point, you comment about, you know, Graham Chapman's chronic lateness, and we know his problems. He had problems with alcohol, and we know that John Cleese was having difficulty continuing with the group and wanting outside work and whatnot. And that at one point you stopped yourself. You literally stopped yourself in a sentence and said, "But I want this to be a kind diary."
Yes,
and
yeah.
I would point out that was early on.
Yeah, it was very early on, and I just thought, "Wow, that takes a lot of willpower."
Well, it's my natural inclination is to be a conciliator, to be an optimist, and I think it was Virginia Woolf said something very, very similar. Said, you know, in a diary, you're actually presenting yourself as you would like yourself to be, whether you know it or not. You are,
right.
and. I generally am hopelessly optimistic, and I always think, well, things are going to turn out fine in the end, and I'd rather be happy than unhappy. So that when there are things that come in, you know, like the Tory government getting in again or whatever, that made me truly depressed. Mm. The fact that I've put that in at all must show that it meant a lot to me. But generally speaking, I always thought we'd, you know, I looked for the positive side to a day. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to feel a day had been just wasted in negative thoughts.
Right.
Well, getting back to what Deborah was talking about a second ago, do you still keep a diary, or have you gone on to that diary of the digital age, the blog?
Oh, no, I still keep a diary, and I still keep it, write it longhand in mm-hmm. notebooks, and it's very important to me. No, I haven't gone on to the blog or anything like that. Writing it out in longhand is all part of the ritual for me, and I try and do it most mornings. Not every day, because I think you become obsessive, and Alan Bennett, one of our great writers, said, you know, he gave up writing a diary because he was living for the diary. The only reason I was doing things was so I could find something to put in the diary. I thought, well, that's probably a dangerous stage to be at.
Right. I think I have to say, though, the most admirable thing is that you had very young children. I myself have a 10-month-old, and I do journal, but I haven't as much anymore, and you keep it up.
I know. I surprised myself, but I think if you read the very often moments when I think I'm going to give this up, and in fact, there's a whole section of the diary about 3 months which we lost because
right,
I think my middle son William threw it in the bin.
That's the family story.
Before reading it, how could he?
Deborah, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks, Deborah. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, let's see if we can go to this is Liz. Liz with us from Utica, New York.
Yeah, hi. I am so honored to be talking to Sir Galahad the Chaste.
not chaste any longer.
No, I wanted to make a comment about diary. You know, I kept diaries off and on through the years, and I found them very therapeutic. I'm wondering if Michael has found them the same. And also, how did he come up with his idea for his travel series?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with you about the therapeutic effect of keeping a diary. For me, it's in two ways. One is that I think it's quite good to be forced to record what you've done, however trite it may seem. It is a record of a day at a certain time, and you will never, ever remember that in quite the same way unless you write it down at the time. So I think that's important. I think the other thing is that I like to just start the day writing something, having to describe just what happened the day before, people I met. It's fairly concentrated. I don't usually have that much time. So in a half hour, which is roughly about the average time I spend on the diary in the morning, I have to try and concentrate my mind on what I saw, what I heard, and put it down in a reasonably sort of condensed fashion. So I think that's just good exercise for writing.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, you're more disciplined than I am.
Well, no, I mean, I have become like that over the years because I feel it's worth keeping it, and it's worth keeping it up. But there are many days I think, why am I writing this? Who on earth is interesting? And some part of me says, well, I don't care who's interested. It's done me some good to have got that down. And you ask about the travel series. Well, in 1988, just after I'd finished a movie called A Fish Called Wanda, with John Cleese and Kevin and Jamie. I was sort of sitting around with nothing much to do. That was such a good movie and such a good script. There was nothing else around to touch it, and someone came along and said, would you present Around the World in 80 Days? Were you actually going to send somebody out around the world in real time with a camera, seeing if you can do it in 80 days as Phileas Fogg would have done in the novel without taking any aircraft? And I just... Somebody can travel around the world, someone else paying. Yeah, I'll do it. I just said yes. And they said, that's wonderful.
Oh, you are so lucky. Well, thanks a lot for talking to me.
Okay, thanks.
Liz, thanks for the call. Yep. Our guest is Michael Palin. His most recent book is Michael Palin, Diaries 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Don't forget our email challenge, Day After Labor Day, How Did Your Life Change Today? Email us, talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And Michael Palin, a lot of the book, at least the parts I've read, there's a lot about censorship and difficulties with the BBC, indeed difficulties with the censorship in the United States as well. But nevertheless, I wondered whether writing in that situation where you were trying to be sneaky, if it will, if you will, or get something through, whether in fact that might have been easier or at least more stimulating than the current climate where you can pretty much say or do anything you want.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think that we were there at a sort of period where things were beginning to change. I mean, the old, very authoritarian establishment was beginning to take a few blows in the UK, and you were able to say things about prime ministers, and you were able to sort of have jokes with Vickers in and all that sort of stuff, and even the military. And that the hard work had been done by a show called Beyond the Fringe before that with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. But yes, I think it's true somehow that the constant sort of brushes with authority kept us on our toes, and we weren't necessarily trying to sneak something past them, but we were forced to examine why we should say things, why we shouldn't say things. But I have to say, a lot of the censorship early on was fairly trivial. I mean, whether you can say the word masturbation or not in a comedy sketch. Now you have long discussions about it on television, you know, with Diagram. But, you know, in those days we had to argue with the BBC over saying a word like that. But I think Python always thrived on having some opposition and someone telling us, no, we couldn't do that, or we shouldn't do that. Mm. But I think the battles were exaggerated until we took on ABC television in the States when they wanted to cut 8 minutes out of every show in order to make room for adverts, and federal standards and practices came with very, very strange conditions, like you can't show two men holding hands going off into the sunset. That was strange, but there again, gave us a good fight. We came over, Terry Gilliam and myself went to the federal courthouse in New York. We lost the case, but we won the war, and later the appeal court judges said that, you know, the BBC had sold this illegally, and the copyright was with the Pythons. It was a major, major decision for us, which gave us the rights to our material. So thank you, American Justice.
Let's see, we get a call in from William. William with us from Los Gatos in California.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi, William.
And actually, this wasn't the question I was going to ask, but since you've mentioned it, I'm an attorney, and I had to study that case
right.
You just mentioned in my intellectual property class in law school, and I think it concerned standing because Terry Gilliam was the American.
Yes, exactly.
But, for what it's worth, it's you've made your legal impact. The question I was calling about was why you play so many running characters who are just plain sneaky.
Sneaky. Well, I'm not quite sure.
I could provide examples of, I think there's Luigi Vercotti.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The mafia gentleman who's not quite on the up and up. And, of course, the purveyor of parrots who aren't quite well. And and I think you've indicated that you don't have too many specific human beings that you model these on. But what do you find so funny about it?
Well, I always like people who have a deluded sense of their own power. When quite manifestly, they're not. There's nothing to back it up. And I love the Vercotti brothers were just these guys who were on the make, but always in a very trivial ways, you know, and quite deluded, going to offer the British Army protection, you know, just these two of them biting on matches and knocking things off the table to show they were serious, you know. I just love that. They're like little slightly sort of Walter Mitty characters. But the other characters, I don't know if you'd call them sneaky, but I used to play a lot of shopkeepers. And John and I work quite well together in that way because I'd play these characters who would be very irritating, are very irritating. And John was very, very good at playing someone who was irritated. And he would get the higher peak of hysteria and frenzy. And I've never known anyone do it as well. I mean, John is brilliant at that. And I would just sort of, it was like a tennis game where you were playing someone who wasn't very good, but they always got the ball back. And John kept going on and on and on. But I always like these characters who are sort of, they're the back row of the photographs in history, you know. And yet they have a profound effect on people in the front row. So in a sense, it was trying to sort of, I suppose it was a comment on power. And one of the great things I remember doing was Pontius Pilate in Life of Brian, who had the unfortunate speech impediment. So everyone laughed at him whenever he said anything. And we played this in on this amazing sort of set in Italy.
That was the biggest character?
Yeah, no, it was not Biggest Dickus. He was Pontius Pilate, anyway. But to have the whole audience laughing at you while you are the powerful character shows how ridicule could be an enormously strong element in sort of anti-authoritarianism.
Michael Palin, thanks so much. Good luck with it.
Thanks.
Michael Palin, the author of Diaries, The Python Years. This is NPR News.